expectation of his refusal, and her own displeasure in advance. She had not invited him to dinner that night. If he wanted distance, then let him have it. Of the four dolphins whose tail supported the shell on which the Triton squatted, the one nearest to Cecilia had its wide-open mouth stopped with moss and algae. Its spherical stone eyeballs, as big as apples, were iridescent green. The whole statue had acquired, around its northerly surfaces, a bluish-green patina, so that from certain approaches and in low light, the muscle-bound Triton really seemed 100 leagues under the sea. Bernini's intention must have been for the water to trickle musically from the wide shell, with its irregular edges, into the basin below. But the pressure was too weak, so that instead the water slid soundlessly down the underside of the shell, where opportunistic slime hung in dripping points, like stalactites in a limestone cave. The basin itself was over 3 feet deep and clear. The bottom was of a pale, creamy stone, over which undulating white-edged rectangles of refracted sunlight divided and overlapped. Her idea was to lean over the parapet and hold the flowers in the vase while she lowered it on its side into the water. But it was at this point that Robbie, wanting to make amends, tried to be helpful. "Let me take that," he said, stretching out a hand. "I'll fill it for you and you take the flowers." "I can manage, thanks." She was already holding the vase over the basin. But he said, "Look, I've got it." And he had, tightly between forefinger and thumb. "Your cigarette will get wet. Take the flowers." This was a command on which he tried to confer urgent masculine authority. The effect on Cecilia was to cause her to tighten her grip. She had no time, and certainly no inclination, to explain that plunging vase and flowers into the water would help with the natural look she wanted in the arrangement. She tightened her hold and twisted her body away from him. He was not so easily shaken off. With a sound like a dry twig snapping, a section of the lip of the vase came away in his hand and split into two triangular pieces which dropped into the water and tumbled to the bottom in a synchronous seesawing motion and lay there several inches apart, writhing in the broken light. Cecilia and Robbie froze in the attitude of their struggle. Their eyes met, and what she saw in the bilious melange of green and orange was not shock or guilt, but a form of challenge, or even triumph. She had the presence of mind to set the ruined vase back down on the step before letting herself confront the significance of the accident. It was irresistible, she knew, even delicious, for the graver it was, the worse it would be for Robbie. Her dead uncle, her father's dear brother, the wasteful war, the treacherous crossing of the river, the preciousness beyond money, the heroism and goodness, all the years backed up behind the history of the vase reaching back to the genius of Herold, and beyond him to the mastery of the arcanists who had reinvented porcelain. "You idiot! Look what you've done!" He looked into the water. Then he looked back at her and simply shook his head as he raised a hand to cover his mouth. By this gesture, he assumed full responsibility. But at that moment, she hated him for the inadequacy of the response. He glanced toward the basin and sighed. For a moment, he thought she was about to step backward onto the vase, and he raised his hand and pointed, though he said nothing. Instead, he began to unbutton his shirt. Immediately, she knew what he was about. Intolerable. He had come to the house and removed his shoes and socks. Well, she would show him then. She kicked off her sandals, unbuttoned her blouse and removed it, unfastened her skirt and stepped out of it and went to the basin wall. He stood with hands on his hips and stared as she climbed into the water in her underwear. Denying his help, any possibility of making amends, was his punishment. The unexpectedly freezing water that caused her to gasp was his punishment. She held her breath and sank, leaving her hair fanned out across the surface. Drowning herself would be his punishment. When she emerged a few seconds later with a piece of pottery in each hand, he knew better than to offer to help her out of the water. The frail white nymph, from whom water cascaded far more successfully than it did from the beefy Triton, carefully placed the pieces by the vase. She dressed quickly, turning her wet arms with difficulty through her silk sleeves, and tucking the unfastened blouse into the skirt. She picked up her sandals and thrust them under her arm, put the fragments in the pocket of her skirt, and took up the vase. Her movements were savage, and she would not meet his eye. He did not exist. He was banished. And this was also the punishment. He stood there dumbly as she walked away from him, barefoot across the lawn, and he watched her darkened hair swing heavily across her shoulders, drenching her blouse. Then he turned and looked into the water in case there was a piece she had missed. It was difficult to see because the roiling surface had yet to recover its tranquillity, and the turbulence was driven by the lingering spirit of her fury. He put his hand flat upon the surface as though to quell it. She, meanwhile, had disappeared into the house. Chapter 3. According to the poster in the hallway, the date of the first performance of The Trials of Arabella was only one day after the first rehearsal. However, it was not easy for the writer-director to find clear time for concentrated work. As on the preceding afternoon, the trouble lay in assembling the cast. During the night, Arabella's disapproving father, Jackson, had wet the bed, as troubled small boys far from home will, and was obliged, by current theory, to carry his sheets and pyjamas down to the laundry and wash them himself by hand under the supervision of Betty, who had been instructed to be distant and firm. This was not represented to the boy as a punishment, the idea being to instruct his unconscious that future lapses would entail inconvenience and hard work. But he was bound to feel it as reproof as he stood at the vast stone sink, which rose level to his chest, suds creeping up his bare arms to soak his rolled-up shirt sleeves, the wet sheets as heavy as a dead dog, and a general sense of calamity numbing his will. Bryony came down at intervals to check on his progress. She was forbidden to help, and Jackson, of course, had never laundered a thing in his life. The two washes, countless rinses, and the sustained two-handed grappling with the mangle, as well as the 15 trembling minutes he had afterward at the kitchen table with bread and butter and a glass of water, took up 2 hours' rehearsal time. Betty told Hardman, when he came in from the morning heat, for his pint of ale, that it was enough that she was having to prepare a special roast dinner in such weather, and that she personally thought the treatment too harsh, and would have administered several sharp smacks to the buttocks and washed the sheets herself. This would have suited Bryony, for the morning was slipping away. When her mother came down to see for herself that the task was done, it was inevitable that a feeling of release should settle on the participants, and in Mrs. Tallis's mind, a degree of unacknowledged guilt, so that when Jackson asked in a small voice if he might please now be allowed a swim in the pool, and could his brother come too, his wish was immediately granted, and Bryony's objections generously brushed aside, as though she were the one who was imposing unpleasant ordeals on a helpless little fellow. So there was swimming, and then there had to be lunch. Rehearsals had continued without Jackson, but it was undermining not to have the important first scene, Arabella's leave-taking, brought to perfection, and Pierrot was too nervous about the fate of his brother down in the bowels of the house to be much in the way of a dastardly foreign count. Whatever happened to Jackson would be Pierrot's future too. He made frequent trips to the lavatory at the end of the corridor. When Bryony returned from one of her visits to the laundry, he asked her, "Has he had the spanking?" "Not as yet." Like his brother, Pierrot had the knack of depriving his lines of any sense. He intoned a roll call of words. Do you think you can escape from my clutches? All present and correct. It's a question, Bryony cut in. Don't you see? It goes up at the end.
What do you mean?
There, you just did it. You start low and end high. It's a question. He swallowed hard, drew a breath, and made another attempt, producing this time a roll call on a rising chromatic scale. At the end, it goes up at the end. Now came a roll call on the old monotone, with a break of register, a yodel on the final syllable. Lola had come to the nursery that morning in the guise of the adult she considered herself at heart to be. She wore pleated flannel trousers that ballooned at the hips and flared at the ankle, and a short-sleeved sweater made of cashmere. Other tokens of maturity included a velvet choker of tiny pearls, the ginger tresses gathered at the nape and secured with an emerald clasp, 3 loose silver bracelets around a freckled wrist, and the fact that whenever she moved, the air about her tasted of rose water. Her condescension, being wholly restrained, was all the more potent. She was coolly responsive to Bryony's suggestions, spoke her lines, which she seemed to have learned overnight, with sufficient expression, and was gently encouraging to her little brother, without encroaching at all on the director's authority. It was as if Cecilia, or even their mother, had agreed to spend some time with the little ones by taking on a role in the play, and was determined not to let a trace of boredom show. What was missing was any demonstration of ragged, childish enthusiasm. When Bryony had shown her cousins the sales booth and the collection box the evening before, the twins had fought each other for the best front-of-house roles. But Lola had crossed her arms and paid decorous, grown-up compliments through a half-smile that was too opaque for the detection of irony. How marvellous! How awfully clever of you, Bryony, to think of that. Did you really make it all by yourself?
This ends Disc 1. Atonement, Disc 10.
During the last days of May, the deliveries of medical supplies increased. More non-urgent cases were sent home. Many wards would have been completely emptied had it not been for the admission of 40 sailors. A rare type of jaundice was sweeping through the Royal Navy. Bryony no longer had time to notice. New courses on hospital nursing and preliminary anatomy began. The first-year students hurried from their shifts to their lectures, to their meals and to private study. After 3 pages of reading, it would be difficult to stay awake. The chimes of Big Ben marked every change of the day, and there were times when the solemn single note of the quarter hour prompted moans of suppressed panic as the girls realized they were supposed to be elsewhere. Total bed rest was considered a medical procedure in itself. Most patients, whatever their condition, were forbidden to walk the few steps to the lavatory. The days, therefore, began with bedpans. Sister did not approve of them being carried down the ward like tennis rackets. They were to be carried to the glory of God, and emptied, sluiced, cleaned, and stowed by 7:30, when it was time to start the morning drinks. All day long, bedpans, blanket bathing, floor cleaning. The girls complained of backache from bed-making and fiery sensations in their feet from standing all day. An extra nursing duty was drawing the blackout over the huge ward windows. Toward the end of the day, more bedpans, the emptying of sputum mugs, the making of cocoa. There was barely time between the end of a shift and the beginning of a class to get back to the dormitory to collect papers and textbooks. Twice in one day, Bryony had caught the disapproval of the ward sister for running in the corridor, and on each occasion the reprimand was delivered tonelessly. Only hemorrhages and fires were permissible reasons for a nurse to run. But the principal domain of the junior probationers was the sluice room. There was talk of automatic bedpan and bottle washers being installed, but this was mere rumour of a promised land. For now, they must do as others had done before them. On the day she had been told off twice for running, Bryony found herself sent to the sluice room for an extra turn. It may have been an accident of the unwritten roster, but she doubted it. She pulled the sluice room door behind her and tied the heavy rubber apron around her waist. The trick of emptying, in fact, the only way it was possible for her, was to close her eyes, hold her breath, and avert her head. Then came the rinsing and a solution of carbolic. If she neglected to check that hollow bedpan handles were cleaned and dry, she would be in deeper trouble with the sister. From this task, she went straight to tidying the near-empty ward at the end of the day, straightening lockers, emptying ashtrays, picking up the day's newspapers. Automatically, she glanced at a folded page of the Sunday Graphic. She had been following the news in unrelated scraps. There was never enough time to sit down and read a paper properly. She knew about the breaching of the Maginot Line, the bombing of Rotterdam, the surrender of the Dutch army, and some of the girls had been talking the night before about the imminent collapse of Belgium. The war was going badly, but it was bound to pick up. It was one anodyne sentence that caught her attention now, not for what it said, but for what it blandly tried to conceal. The British army in northern France was making strategic withdrawals to previously prepared positions. Even she, who knew nothing of military strategy or journalistic convention, understood a euphemism for retreat. Perhaps she was the last person in the hospital to understand what was happening. The emptying wards, the flow of supplies, she had thought were simply part of general preparations for war. She had been too wrapped up in her own tiny concerns. Now she saw how the separate news items might connect, and understood what everyone else must know and what the hospital administration was planning for. The Germans had reached the Channel. The British Army was in difficulties. It had all gone badly wrong in France, though no one knew on what kind of scale. This foreboding, this muted dread, was what she had sensed around her. About this time, on the day the last patients were escorted from the ward, a letter came from her father. After a cursory greeting and inquiry after the course and her health, he passed on information picked up from a colleague and confirmed by the family. Paul Marshall and Lola Quincy were to be married a week Saturday in the Church of the Holy Trinity, Clapham Common. He gave no reason why he supposed she would want to know and made no comment on the matter himself. He simply signed off in a scrawl down the page, "Love as always." All morning, as she went about her duties, she thought about the news. She had not seen Lola since that summer, so the figure she imagined at the altar was a spindly girl of 15. Bryony helped a departing patient, an elderly lady from Lambeth, pack her suitcase and tried to concentrate on her complaints. She had broken her toe and been promised 12 days bed rest, and had had only 7. She was helped into a wheelchair and a porter took her away. On duty in the sluice room, Bryony did the sums. Lola was 20, Marshall would be 29. It wasn't a surprise. The shock was in the confirmation. Bryony was more than implicated in this union. She had made it possible. Throughout the day, up and down the ward, along the corridors, Bryony felt her familiar guilt pursue her with a novel vibrancy. She scrubbed down the vacated lockers, helped wash bed frames in carbolic, swept and polished the floors, ran errands to the dispensary and the almoner at double speed without actually running, was sent with another probationer to help dress a boil in Men's General, and covered for Fiona, who had to visit the dentist. On this first really fine day of May, she sweated under her starchy uniform. All she wanted to do was work, then bathe and sleep, until it was time to work again. But it was all useless, she knew. Whatever skivvying or humble nursing she did, and however well or hard she did it, whatever illumination and tutorial she had relinquished or lifetime moment on a college lawn, she would never undo the damage. She was unforgivable. For the first time in years, she thought that she would like to talk to her father. She had always taken his remoteness for granted and expected nothing. She wondered whether in sending his letter with its specific information, he was trying to tell her that he knew the truth. After tea, leaving herself too little time, she went to the phone box outside the hospital entrance near Westminster Bridge and attempted to call him at his work. The switchboard put her through to a helpful nasal voice, and then the connection was broken and she had to start again. The same happened, and on her third attempt the line went dead as soon as a voice said, "Trying to connect you." By this time she had run out of change, and she was due back on the ward. She paused outside the phone box to admire the huge cumulus clouds piled against a pale blue sky. The river, with its spring tide racing seaward, reflected the colour with dashes of green and grey. Big Ben seemed to be endlessly toppling forward against the restless sky. Despite the traffic fumes, there was a scent of fresh vegetation around, newly cut grass perhaps from the hospital gardens, or from young trees along the riverside. Though the light was brilliant, there was a delicious coolness in the air. She had seen or felt nothing so pleasing in days, perhaps weeks. She was indoors too much, breathing disinfectant. As she came away, two young army officers, medics from the military hospital on Millbank, gave her a friendly smile as they brushed past her. Automatically she glanced down, then immediately regretted that she had not at least met their look. They walked away from her across the bridge, oblivious to everything but their own conversation. One of them mimed reaching up high, as though to grope for something on a shelf, and his companion laughed. Halfway across, they stopped to admire a gunboat gliding under the bridge. She thought how lively and free the RAMC doctors looked, and wished she had returned their smiles. There were parts of herself she had completely forgotten. She was late, and she had every reason to run, despite the shoes that pinched her toes. Here, on the stained, uncarbolized pavement, the writ of Sister Drummond did not apply. No hemorrhages or fires, but it was a surprising physical pleasure, a brief taste of freedom to run as best she could in her starched apron to the hospital entrance. Now a languorous waiting settled over the hospital. Only the jaundiced seaman remained. There was much fascination and amused talk about them among the nurses. These tough ratings sat up in bed darning their socks and insisted on hand-washing their own smalls, which they dried on washing lines improvised from string suspended along the radiators. Those who were still bedbound would suffer agonies rather than call for the bottle. It was said the able seamen insisted on keeping the ward shipshape themselves and had taken over the sweeping and the heavy bumper. Such domesticity among men was unknown to the girls, and Fiona said she would marry no man who had not served in the Royal Navy. For no apparent reason, the probationers were given a half day off, free from study, though they were to remain in uniform. After lunch, Bryony walked with Fiona across the river past the Houses of Parliament and into St James's Park. They strolled around the lake, bought tea at a stall, and rented deck chairs to listen to elderly men of the Salvation Army playing Elgar adapted for brass band. In those days of May, before the story from France was fully understood, before the bombing of the city in September, London had the outward signs, but not yet the mentality, of war. uniforms, posters warning against fifth columnists, two big air raid shelters dug into the park lawns, and everywhere surly officialdom. While the girls were sitting on their deck chairs, a man in armband and cap came over and demanded to see Fiona's gas mask. It was partially obscured by her cape. Otherwise, it was still an innocent time. The anxieties about the situation in France that had been absorbing the country had for the moment dissipated in the afternoon sunshine. The dead were not yet present. The absent were presumed alive. The scene was dreamlike in its normality. Prams drifted along the paths, hoods down in full sunlight, and white, soft-skulled babies gaped at the outdoor world for the first time. Children, who seemed to have escaped evacuation, ran about on the grass, shouting and laughing. The band struggled with music beyond its capabilities, and deck chairs still cost tuppence. It was hard to believe that a couple of hundred miles away was a military disaster. Bryony's thoughts remained fixed on her themes. Perhaps London would be overwhelmed by poisonous gas, or overrun by German parachutists, aided on the ground by fifth columnists before Lola's wedding could take place. Bryony had heard a know-all porter saying, with what sounded like satisfaction, that nothing now could stop the German army. They had the new tactics and we didn't. They had modernised and we had not. The generals should have read Little Hart's book, or have come to the hospital porter's lodge and listened carefully during tea break. At her side, Fiona talked of her adored little brother and the clever thing he had said at dinner, while Bryony pretended to listen and thought about Robbie. If he had been fighting in France, he might already be captured. Or worse. How would Cecilia survive such news? As the music, enlivened by unscored dissonances, swelled to a raucous climax, she gripped the wooden sides of her chair, closed her eyes. If something happened to Robbie, if Cecilia and Robbie were never to be together... Her secret torment and public upheaval of war had always seemed separate worlds, but now she understood how the war might compound her crime. The only conceivable solution would be for the past never to have happened. If he didn't come back... She longed to have someone else's past, to be someone else, like hearty Fiona with her unstained life stretching ahead, and her affectionate, sprawling family, whose dogs and cats had Latin names, whose home was a famous venue for artistic Chelsea people. All Fiona had to do was live her life, follow the road ahead, and discover what was to happen. To Bryony, it appeared that her life was going to be lived in one room without a door. Bryony? Are you all right? What? Yes, of course, I'm fine, thanks. I don't believe you. Shall I get you some water? As the applause grew, no one seemed to mind how bad the band was, she watched Fiona go across the grass, past the musicians and the man in a brown coat renting out the deck chairs, to the little cafe among the trees. The Salvation Army was starting in on Bye Bye Blackbird, at which they were far more adept. People in their deck chairs were joining in, and some were clapping in time. Communal sing-alongs had a faintly coercive quality, the way strangers had of catching each other's eye as their voices rose, which she was determined to resist. Still, it lifted her spirits, and when Fiona returned with a teacup of water, and the band began a medley of old-time favourites with It's a Long Way to Tipperary, they began to talk about work. Fiona drew Bryony into the gossip, about which pros they liked and those that irritated them, about Sister Drummond, whose voice Fiona could do, and the matron, who was almost as grand and remote as a consultant. They remembered the eccentricities of various patients, and they shared grievances. Fiona was outraged that she wasn't allowed to keep things on her windowsill. Bryony hated the 11 o'clock lights out. But they did so with self-conscious enjoyment and increasingly with a great deal of giggling, so that heads began to turn in their direction and fingers were laid theatrically over lips. But these gestures were only half serious, and most of those who turned smiled indulgently from their deck chairs, for there was something about two young nurses, nurses in wartime, in their purple and white tunics, dark blue capes and spotless caps, that made them as irreproachable as nuns. The girls sensed their immunity, and their laughter grew louder into cackles of hilarity and derision. Fiona turned out to be a good mimic, and for all her merriness, there was a cruel touch to her humour that Bryony liked. Fiona had her own version of Lambeth Cockney, and with heartless exaggeration caught the ignorance of some patients and their pleading, whining voices.
"It's me heart, nurse. It's always been on the wrong side. Me mum was just the same." "Is it true your baby comes out of your bottom, nurse? 'Cause I don't know how mine's going to fit, seeing as how I'm always blocked."
"I had 6 nippers, then I goes and leaves one on a bus, the 88, up from Brixton. Must have left him on the seat. Never saw him again, nurse. Really upset I was. Cried me eyes out."
As they walked back toward Parliament Square, Bryony was light-headed and still weak in the knees from laughing so hard. She wondered at herself, at how quickly her mood could be transformed. Her worries did not disappear, but slipped back, their emotional power temporarily exhausted. Arm in arm, the girls walked across Westminster Bridge. The tide was out, and in such strong light there was a purple sheen on the mud banks where thousands of worm casts threw tiny sharp shadows. As Bryony and Fiona turned right onto Lambeth Palace Road, they saw a line of army lorries drawn up outside the main entrance. The girls groaned good-humouredly at the prospect of more supplies to be unpacked and stowed. Then they saw the field ambulances among the lorries, and coming closer, they saw the stretchers, scores of them set down haphazardly on the ground, and an expanse of dirty green battle dress and stained bandages. There were also soldiers standing in groups, dazed and immobile, and wrapped like the men on the ground in filthy bandages. A medical orderly was gathering rifles from the back of a lorry. A score of porters, nurses and doctors were moving through the crowd. 5 or 6 trolleys had been brought out to the front of the hospital, clearly not enough. For a moment, Bryony and Fiona stopped and looked, and then at the same moment, they began to run. In less than a minute, they were down among the men. The brisk air of spring did not dispel the stench of engine oil and festering wounds. The soldiers' faces and hands were black, and with their stubble and matted black hair and their tied-on labels from the casualty receiving stations, they looked identical, a wild race of men from a terrible world. The ones who were standing appeared to be asleep. More nurses and doctors were pouring out of the entrance. A consultant was taking charge, and a rough triage system was in place. Some of the urgent cases were being lifted onto the trolleys. For the first time in her training, Bryony found herself addressed by a doctor, a registrar she had never seen before. "You, get on the end of this stretcher." The doctor himself took the other end. She had never carried a stretcher before, and the weight of it surprised her. They were through the entrance and 10 yards down the corridor, and she knew her left wrist could not hold up. She was at the feet end. The soldier had a sergeant's stripes. He was without his boots, and his bluish toes stank. His head was wrapped in a bandage soaked to crimson and black. On his thigh, his battle dress was mangled into a wound. She thought she could see the white protuberance of bone. Each step they took gave him pain. His eyes were shut tight, but he opened and closed his mouth in silent agony. If her left hand failed, The stretcher would certainly tip. Her fingers were loosening as they reached the lift, stepped inside, and set the stretcher down. While they slowly rose, the doctor felt the man's pulse and breathed in sharply through his nose. He was oblivious to Bryony's presence. As the second floor sank into their view, she thought only of the 30 yards of corridor to the ward and whether she would make it. It was her duty to tell the doctor that she couldn't. But his back was to her as he slammed the lift gates apart and told her to take her end. She willed more strength to her left arm, and she willed the doctor to go faster. She would not bear the disgrace if she were to fail. The black-faced man opened and closed his mouth in a kind of chewing action. His tongue was covered in white spots. His black Adam's apple rose and fell, and she made herself stare at that. They turned into the ward, and she was lucky that an emergency bed was ready by the door. Her fingers were already slipping. A sister and a qualified nurse were waiting. As the stretcher was manoeuvred into position alongside the bed, Bryony's fingers went slack. She had no control over them, and she brought up her left knee in time to catch the weight. The wooden handle thumped against her leg. The stretcher wobbled, and it was the sister who leaned in to steady it. The wounded sergeant blew through his lips a sound of incredulity, as though he had never guessed that pain could be so vast. "For God's sake, girl," the doctor muttered. They eased their patient onto the bed. Bryony waited to find out if she was needed, but now the three were busy and ignored her. The nurse was removing the head bandage, and the sister was cutting away the soldier's trousers. The registrar turned away to the light to study the notes scribbled on the label he had pulled away from the man's shirt. Bryony cleared her throat softly, and the sister looked round and was annoyed to find her still there. "Well, don't just stand idle, Nurse Tallis. Get downstairs and help." She came away humiliated and felt a hollow sensation spreading in her stomach. The moment the war touched her life, at the first moment of pressure, she had failed. If she was made to carry another stretcher, she would not make it halfway to the lift. But if she was told to, she would not dare refuse. If she dropped her end, she would simply leave, gather her things from her room into her suitcase, and go to Scotland and work as a land girl. It would be better for everyone. As she hurried along the ground floor corridor, she met Fiona coming the other way on the front of a stretcher. She was a stronger girl than Bryony. The face of the man she was carrying was completely obliterated by dressings, with a dark oval hole for his mouth. The girl's eyes met, and something passed between them, shock or shame that they had been laughing in the park when there was this. Bryony went outside and saw with relief the last of the stretchers being lifted onto extra trolleys and porters waiting to push them. A dozen qualified nurses were standing to one side with their suitcases. She recognised some from her own ward. There was no time to ask them where they were being sent. Something even worse was happening elsewhere. The priority now was the walking wounded. There were still more than 200 of them. A sister told her to lead 15 men up to Beatrice Ward. They followed her in single file back down the corridor, like children in a school crocodile. Some had their arms in slings. Others had head or chest wounds. 3 men walked on crutches. No one spoke. There was a jam around the lifts with trolleys waiting to get to the operating theatres in the basement, and others still trying to get up to the wards. She found a place in an alcove for the men with crutches to sit, told them not to move, and took the rest up by the stairs. Progress was slow, and they paused on each landing. "Not far now," she kept saying, but they did not seem to be aware of her. When they reached the ward, etiquette required her to report to the sister. She was not in her office. Bryony turned to her crocodile, which had bunched up behind her. They did not look at her. They were staring past her into the grand Victorian space of the ward, the lofty pillars, the potted palms, the neatly ranged beds, and their pure turned-down sheets. "You wait here," she said. "The sister will find you all a bed." She walked quickly to the far end, where the sister and two nurses were attending a patient. There were shuffling footsteps behind Bryony. The soldiers were coming down the ward. Horrified, she flapped her hands at them. "Go back, please go back and wait." But they were fanning out now across the ward. Each man had seen the bed that was his. Without being assigned, without removing their boots, without bathing and delousing and hospital pyjamas, they were climbing onto the beds. Their filthy hair, their blackened faces were on the pillows. The sister was coming at a sharp pace from her end of the ward, her heels resounding in the venerable space. Bryony went to a bedside and plucked at the sleeve of a soldier who lay face up, cradling his arm which had slipped its sling. As he kicked his legs out straight, he made a scar of oil stain across his blanket. All her fault. "You must get up," she said as the sister was upon her. She added feebly, "There's a procedure." "The men need to sleep. The procedures are for later." The voice was Irish. The sister put a hand on Brian's shoulder and turned her so that her name badge could be read. "You'll go back to your ward now, Nurse Tallis. You'll be needed there, I should think." With the gentlest of shoves, Bryony was sent about her business. The ward could do without disciplinarians like her. The men around her were already asleep, and again she had been proved an idiot. Of course they should sleep. She had only wanted to do what she thought was expected. These weren't her rules, after all. They had been dinned into her these past few months, the thousand details of a new admission. How was she to know they meant nothing, in fact? These indignant thoughts afflicted her until she was almost at her own ward, when she remembered the men with crutches downstairs, waiting to be brought up in the lift. She hurried down the stairs. The alcove was empty, and there was no sign of the men in corridors. She did not want to expose her ineptitude by asking among the nurses or porters. Someone must have gathered the wounded men up. In the days that followed, she never saw them again. Her own ward had been redesignated as an overflow to acute surgical, but the definitions meant nothing at first. It could have been a clearing station on the front line. Sisters and senior nurses had been drafted in to help, and five or six doctors were working on the most urgent cases. There were two padres, one sitting and talking to a man lying on his side, the other praying by a shape under a blanket. All the nurses wore masks, and they and the doctors had rolled up their sleeves. The sisters moved between the beds swiftly, giving injections, probably morphine, or administering the transfusion needles to connect the injured to the vacoliters of whole blood and the yellow flasks of plasma that hung like exotic fruits from the tall mobile stands. Probationers moved down the ward with piles of hot water bottles. The soft echo of voices, medical voices, filled the ward and was pierced regularly by groans and shouts of pain. Every bed was occupied, and new cases were left on the stretchers and laid between the beds to take advantage of the transfusion stands. Two orderlies were getting ready to take away the dead men. At many beds, nurses were removing dirty dressings. Always a decision, to be gentle and slow, or firm and quick and have it over with in one moment of pain. This ward favoured the latter, which accounted for some of the shouts. Everywhere a soup of smells, the sticky, sour odour of fresh blood, and also filthy clothes, sweat, oil, disinfectant, medical alcohol, and drifting above it all, the stink of gangrene. Two cases going down to the theatre turned out to be amputations. with senior nurses seconded to casualty-receiving hospitals further out in the hospital sector, and more cases coming in, the qualified nurses gave orders freely, and the probationers of Bryony's set were given new responsibilities. A nurse sent Bryony to remove the dressing and clean the leg wound of a corporal lying on a stretcher near the door. She was not to dress it again until one of the doctors had looked at it. The corporal was face down and grimaced when she knelt to speak in his ear.
"Don't mind me if I scream," he murmured. "Clean it up, nurse. I don't want to lose it."
The trouser leg had been cut clear. The outer bandaging looked relatively new. She began to unwind it, and when it was impossible to pass her hand under his leg, she used scissors to cut the dressing away.
"They did me up on the quayside at Dover."
Now there was only gauze, black with congealed blood, along the length of the wound which ran from his knee to his ankle. The leg itself was hairless and black. She feared the worst and breathed through her mouth.
"Now, how did you do a thing like that?"
She made herself sound chirpy.
"Shell comes over, knocks me back onto this fence of corrugated tin."
"That was bad luck. Now you know this dressing's got to come off." She gently lifted an edge, and the corporal winced. He said,
"Count me in. 1, 2, 3, like, and do it quick."
The corporal clenched his fists. She took the edge she had freed, gripped it hard between forefinger and thumb, and pulled the dressing back in a sudden stroke. A memory came to her from childhood of seeing at an afternoon birthday party the famous tablecloth trick. The dressing came away in one with a gluey rasping sound. The corporal said,
"I'm going to be sick."
There was a kidney bowl to hand. He retched, but produced nothing. In the folds of skin at the back of his neck were beads of perspiration. The wound was 18 inches long, perhaps more, and curved behind his knee. The stitches were clumsy and irregular. Here and there one edge of the ruptured skin rose over the other, revealing its fatty layers, and little obtrusions like miniature bunches of red grapes forced up from the fissure. She said,
"Hold still. I'm going to clean round it, but I won't touch it."
She would not touch it yet. The leg was black and soft, like an overripe banana. She soaked cotton wool in alcohol. Fearful that the skin would simply come away, she made a gentle pass around his calf, 2 inches above the wound. Then she wiped again with a little more pressure. The skin was firm, so she pressed the cotton wool until he flinched. She took away her hand and saw the swath of white skin she had revealed. The cotton wool was black, not gangrene. She couldn't help her gasp of relief. She even felt her throat constrict. He said,
"What is it, nurse? You can tell me."
He pushed up and was trying to look over his shoulder. There was fear in his voice. She swallowed and said neutrally, "I think it's healing well." She took more cotton wool. It was oil or grease, mixed in with beach sand, and it did not come away easily. She cleaned an area 6 inches back, working her way right round the wound. She had been doing this for some minutes when a hand rested on her shoulder and a woman's voice said in her ear, "That's good, Nurse Tallis, but you've got to work faster." She was on her knees, bent over the stretcher, squeezed against a bed, and it was not easy to turn round. By the time she did, she saw only the familiar form retreating. The corporal was asleep by the time Bryony began to clean around the stitches. He flinched and stirred, but did not quite wake. Exhaustion was his anaesthetic. As she straightened at last and gathered her bowl and all the soiled cotton wool, a doctor came and she was dismissed. She
She scrubbed her hands and was set another task. Everything was different for her now she had achieved one small thing. She was set to taking water around to the soldiers who had collapsed with battle exhaustion. It was important that they did not dehydrate. "Come on now, Private Carter. Drink this and you can go back to sleep. Sit up now." She held a little white enamel teapot and let them suck the water from its spout, while she cradled their filthy heads against her apron like giant babies. She scrubbed down again and did a bedpan round. She had never minded it less. She was told to attend to a soldier with stomach wounds who had also lost a part of his nose. She could see through the bloody cartilage into his mouth and onto the back of his lacerated tongue. Her job was to clean up his face. Again, it was oil and sand which had been blasted into the skin. He was awake, she guessed, but he kept his eyes closed. Morphine had calmed him, and he swayed slightly from side to side, as though in time to music in his head. As his features began to appear from behind the mask of black, she thought of those books of glossy blank pages she had in childhood, which she rubbed with a blunt pencil to make a picture appear. She thought, too, how one of these men might be Robbie, how she would dress his wounds without knowing who he was, and with cotton wool tenderly rub his face until his familiar features emerged, and how he would turn to her with gratitude, realize who she was, and take her hand, and in silently squeezing it, forgive her. Then he would let her settle him down into sleep. Her responsibilities increased. She was sent with forceps and a kidney bowl to an adjacent ward, to the bedside of an airman with shrapnel in his leg. He watched her warily as she set her equipment down. "If I'm having them out, I'd rather have an operation." Her hands were trembling, but she was surprised how easily it came to her, the brisk voice of the no-nonsense nurse. She pulled the screen around his bed. "Don't be silly. We'll have them out in a jiff. How did it happen?" While he explained to her that his job was building runways in the fields of northern France, his eyes kept returning to the steel forceps she had collected from the autoclave. They lay dripping in the blue-edged kidney bowl. "We'd get going on the job, then Jerry comes over and dumps his load. We drops back, starts all over in another field, then it's Jerry again and we're falling back again, till we fell into the sea." She smiled and pulled back his bed covers. "Let's have a look, shall we?" The oil and grime had been washed from his legs to reveal an area below his thigh where pieces of shrapnel were embedded in the flesh. He leaned forward, watching her anxiously. She said, "Lie back so I can see what's there." "They're not bothering me or anything." "Just lie back." Several pieces were spread across a 12-inch area. There was swelling and slight inflammation around each rupture in the skin. "I don't mind them, nurse. I'd be happy leaving them where they are." He laughed without conviction. "Something to show my grandchildren." "They're getting infected," she said, "and they could sink." "Sink?" "Into your flesh, into your bloodstream, and get carried to your heart or your brain." He seemed to believe her. He lay back and sighed at the distant ceiling. "Bloody hell. I mean, excuse me, nurse, I don't think I'm up to it today." "Let's count them up together, shall we?" They did so, out loud. 8. She pushed him gently in the chest. "They've got to come out. Lie back now. I'll be as quick as I can. If it helps you, grip the bedhead behind you." His leg was tensed and trembling as she took the forceps. "Don't hold your breath. Try and relax." He made a derisive snorting sound. "Relax." She steadied her right hand with her left. It would have been easier for her to sit on the edge of the bed, but that was unprofessional and strictly prohibited. When she placed her left hand on an unaffected part of his leg, he flinched. She chose the smallest piece she could find on the edge of the cluster. The protruding part was obliquely triangular. She gripped it, paused a second, then pulled it clear, firmly, but without jerking. Fuck! The escaped word ricocheted around the ward and seemed to repeat itself several times. There was silence, or at least a lowering of sound, beyond the screens. Bryony still held the bloody metal fragment between her forceps. It was 3/4 of an inch long and narrowed to a point. Purposeful steps were approaching. She dropped the shrapnel into the kidney bowl as Sister Drummond whisked the screen aside. She was perfectly calm as she glanced at the foot of the bed to take in the man's name and presumably his condition, then stood over him and gazed into his face. "How dare you?" the sister said quietly. And then again, "How dare you speak that way in front of one of my nurses?"
"I beg your pardon, sister. Just came out."
Sister Drummond looked with disdain into the bowl. "Compared to what we've admitted these past few hours, Airman Young, your injuries are superficial, so you'll consider yourself lucky. And you'll show some courage worthy of your uniform. Carry on, Nurse Tallis." Into the silence that followed her departure, Bryony said brightly, "We'll get on, shall we? Only 7 to go. When it's over, I'll bring you a measure of brandy." He sweated, his whole body shook, and his knuckles turned white round the iron bedhead. But he did not make a sound as she continued to pull the pieces clear. "You know, you can shout if you want." But he didn't want a second visit from Sister Drummond, and Bryony understood. She was saving the largest until last. It did not come clear in one stroke. He bucked on the bed and hissed through his clenched teeth. By the second attempt, the shrapnel stuck out 2 inches from his flesh. She tugged it clear on the third try and held it up for him, a gory 4-inch stiletto of irregular steel. He stared at it in wonder.
"Run him under the tap, nurse. I'll take him home."
Then he turned into the pillow and began to sob. It may have been the word home, as well as the pain. She slipped away to get his brandy and stopped in the sluice to be sick. For a long time, she undressed, washed, and dressed the more superficial of the wounds. Then came the order she was dreading. "I want you to go and dress Private Latimer's face." She had already tried to feed him earlier with a teaspoon into what remained of his mouth, trying to spare him the humiliation of dribbling. He had pushed her hand away. Swallowing was excruciating. Half his face had been shot away. What she dreaded, more than the removal of the dressing, was the look of reproach in his large brown eyes. "What have you done to me?" His form of communication was a soft "ah" sound from the back of his throat, a little moan of disappointment. "We'll soon have you fixed," she had kept repeating, and could think of nothing else. And now, approaching his bed with her materials, she said cheerily, "Hello, Private Latimer. It's me again." He looked at her without recognition. She said, as she unpinned the bandage that was secured at the top of his head, "It's going to be all right. You'll walk out of here in a week or two, you'll see. And that's more than we can say for a lot of them in here." That was one comfort. There was always someone worse. Half an hour earlier, they had carried out a multiple amputation on a captain from the East Surreys, the regiment the boys in the village had joined. And then there were the dying. Using a pair of surgical tongs,
She began carefully pulling away the sodden, congealed lengths of ribbon gauze from the cavity in the side of his face. When the last was out, the resemblance to the cutaway model they used in anatomy classes was only faint. This was all ruin, crimson and raw.